Today is July 9th, 2014. This is episode number 262 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, horological enthusiast. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at acm@macobserver.com.
What kind of logic?
Horological enthusiast.
I so completely misheard what you said.
What did you think I said?
Well, I don't want to change our demographic.
That is funny. Although I really meant to say that I'm a lover of watches, which obviously is going to pertain to our story. But I think I may actually be a lover of time, according to that title.
Yeah, I believe so.
Horology is the art or science of measuring time. So yes, apparently I'm an enthusiast for measuring time.
Well, that's no, fine. That totally works. Yeah, that totally
works.
I'll
take works. It. Yeah. I'll take it. But it's mechanical watches that I like, and one can measure time with, say, digital watches or with quartz watches, neither of which I'm a fan of. Or an hourglass. I'm actually a huge fan of an hour or a sundial.
I was about to ask about sundials.
I love sundials and water clocks. Water clocks are cool.
Water clocks are cool. On the sundial things, there's a really cool sundial that's on campus at CU in Boulder, and it sits at an angle. I love how it's set up. On the top side, it's all the summer hours. On the bottom side, it's all the winter hours. And I was standing there looking at it one day thinking, oh my God, this is just so cool, and I love how this is set up and how it works.
Wait, hold on. So, in other words, to be the most accurate, they set up two different ones because of the different angles of the sun involved.
Yes, and they're on the same, or they're on opposite sides of the same big disc. So this thing's like 4 feet across.
So you can get the wrong time if you want, if you're on the wrong side of the disc in the wrong season, or the right side of the disc on the wrong season, whatever.
Right. Except you really don't have any distinct shadow lines to work from if you're on the wrong side of the disc. Yeah.
Okay. So go ahead.
Yeah. So I'm standing there looking at this, and I'm like thinking, man, this is really cool. And someone really went to a lot of work to figure out how to make this work and get the angles right so you could use the one disc for both sides or both seasons. And there's just people standing there. And this one guy, he turns to the people that are with him, and he genuinely asks, how do they know when to turn the disc over?
He did not, man. You were making that up.
Oh, I wish.
People. I don't want for him to have been being ironic. I want that to be genuine stupidity or genuine lack of thought.
I'm pretty sure that he was asking in seriousness, because the other people that were with him, the looks on their face, it was as if they had been slapped with fish.
Fair enough. Did you know, by the way, that another name for a water clock is a clepsydra? Or a clepsydra? Clepsydra?
No, I did not.
C-L-E-P-S-Y-D-R-A is what happens when you start clicking links in Wikipedia.
You know, if you hadn't mentioned the clicking links thing, people would have assumed you just knew that.
Yeah, well, you know, if I could have pronounced it correctly, or at least just stuck to my guns with one pronunciation, I wouldn't have ratted myself out. But as it was, I felt I needed to rat myself out. But according to Wikipedia, it's any timepiece in which time is measured by the regulated flow of liquid into inflow type or out from outflow type of a vessel, where the amount is then measured. Who knew that had a name? I thought it was water clock. It turns out that the Greeks didn't call it water clock.
That's so weird. Because, right? if they just said, this is a water clock, people would have known what they were talking about.
People would have known what they were talking about.
Instead, they decided to call it the Kleptolydia.
Clepsydra. Clepsydra.
Yeah, I've heard it both ways.
Only when you said it.
See, whatever.
How do they know when to turn that thing around? That seems, just right on the spot when they do that.
Yeah, well, I'm just assuming someone's looking at their watch and like, okay, time to turn the clock over.
Yes, that would be in our absurdist fantasy. That's the way that would go.
Now, the best part of that was I was pantomiming looking at a watch on my wrist while I said that. And I don't wear a watch, and this isn't a video show,
That's even better. Oh, God, this just keeps getting better. Now, we have ventured into this. We have started this conversation. And so before we lose all of our listeners, let's pretend that this is all part of the conversation about Apple and the watch industry.
I wasn't pretending.
Okay, all right, whatever. That works. That works because... Now, we know that, all right, this is one of those times when I'm using the show and Jeff to help work through some various issues so that I can write about it later.
I feel like a piece of meat.
Well, you know, sometimes, brother. Sometimes. So, we know that the iWatch is coming, or whatever it is that Apple is going to release for the wearables market.
And for now, just for sake of argument, it's easiest to call it iWatch because that becomes our all-encompassing word.
Right, and we happen to know that Apple owns that trademark. That could have been misdirection.
Sure.
We don't know. We won't know until Apple releases. But for the sake of this show today, it's going to be the iWatch.
Right.
And we have... I think at this point, enough certitude that it's going to be released this fall to say that it's going to be released this fall.
That seems very, very likely.
It does seem likely. You know what's interesting, though? We haven't seen this. This is arguing against what I just said. You and I have talked several times about the fact that there's a point in Apple's product cycle where stuff just starts leaking.
And that's not happening.
And with the iWatch, it has. With the iPhone 6, it has. We've seen that we talked about it on TDO. The Sapphire front case, I believe pretty strongly that the least that is an actual Apple prototype.
I'm totally with you.
Right. We talked about that this week on the Daily Observations, the Daily podcast that Jeff hosts on a
every day.
Daily basis. Yes, you know, let me consult my watch. Yep, that's what daily means. And we're seeing those leaks come out of Apple's supply chain for the iPhone, but we have yet to see those leaks coming out for the iWatch, which is fascinating. Very, very fascinating that we haven't seen that yet. And I don't know why that's the case. It actually, according to the very patterns that you and I have cited, that would mean that Apple is not close to releasing it.
Yep, you're right. Yeah,
but I think Apple is going to release it.
So okay, so we had the Mac Pro, the cylindrical Mac Pro, show up or get introduced without anyone dropping any information about this ahead of time.
Correct.
So it's possible.
Except for Tim Cook, who said that something was coming in the next 18 months, I think.
That's true. But the specifics about the redesigned Mac Pro.
Right. Oh, everything about the form factor we didn't know anything about.
Right. There were no leaked body parts. There were no leaked blurry photographs. There were no insider sources saying, oh my God, you need to see the sexy black cylindrical computer Apple's designing.
But here's the difference there. Those employees are Apple employees that are making that thing. And as we understand it, there's no more than a couple hundred people making those in Austin. There's a lot of robotics at work.
Yeah. Oh, I just assumed they were all handcrafted.
We saw Apple actually released a video showing some of the production techniques. Some of the machines that are actually used to make the body of the thing. But the reason why we said that there's a point in the Apple product cycle where stuff leaks is because there are literally millions of hands involved from the supply chain to the assemblers. There are millions of hands that are involved in those final months, and it's just too many hands to keep some of them from leaking stuff either for profit or for because you know they want to.
And we have seen nothing.
Right. So is it possible that the iPhone could actually be being made by a small team, that despite the rumors of Apple possibly wanting to make tens of millions of these things, even for the first quarter, which it still seems weird to me, that Apple doesn't have a huge team making it? Is it even possible that Apple is assembling those in Arizona with its own team? Remember what Tim Cook said.
Yeah,
Tim Cook said in the annual shareholder meeting that the product being built or being made, or the product that the Arizona, that he was talking about the Arizona facility, because the part of that subject, of course, was their production agreement with GT Advanced Technologies, the guys that make the sapphire displays.
Sapphire glass.
The material. That's being done in Arizona, but Tim Cook went on to say that the product that was being made, and I can't remember the exact wording now, in Arizona, was going to lead to the creation of a new ecosystem.
That's a really good point, and I don't see the trash can Mac is leading to a new ecosystem.
Well, and that's being made in Austin. We know that's not being made.
That's right. That's yeah.
And he also said this several months after the Mac Pro was. Like, you know, 8 months after the Mac Pro was shown.
So maybe he was referring to more than just the fact that they are making the glass for these devices in Arizona.
Yeah, he implied that the product that was being made. Maybe one reason why we haven't seen the iWatch is because it's not being manufactured in China. It's being manufactured in Arizona. And that Apple is using a lot of robotics and therefore has a relatively small team involved in making it. That would explain... If Apple's going to release that this fall, that would explain why we haven't seen a leak for it yet.
Yeah, that would totally make sense, because the people that are working on it are direct Apple employees, and they are not going to screw this up.
Correct.
Yeah, if that's the case, and let's say there's 100 people that are directly involved in the manufacturing.
Let's call it 1,000.
Okay.
Because I think it's going to be made in a lot bigger numbers than the Mac Pro.
Okay, so there's 1,000 people working on this, and they're all direct Apple employees. They have Apple ID numbers. The odds of getting ratted out if you gave up or if you leaked information are pretty high.
Yeah. To wit, look at the complete surprise that some of the stuff in both Yosemite and iOS 8 were. When everybody who's working on the stuff is an Apple employee, Apple has a pretty good chance of keeping it under wraps. It's when we start talking about manufacturing by outside companies, i.e., the entire manufacturing ecosystem that's in China, Taiwan, to a lesser extent Japan. That's when there are just too many people involved.
Yeah,
and of course, you know, we go ahead.
A lot of those people that are involved in iPhone production, iMac production, iPad production, they're people that really don't care about maintaining the secrecy.
No, they're not. They're not paid to care.
No, their job is to drop a circuit on a board.
Yeah, and many of those people are looking to work for a season or a year or two. They're not looking for a career. right? You know, that's there's a lot of a seasonal aspect to manufacturing in China, where people come from the rural areas and look to make enough money and then go back home.
Yeah, and,
right.
Yeah.
So it's a completely different culture. It's a completely different situation. They're not working for Apple. They're working for Foxconn. They're making a lot more money than is the average in the area, but it's still not a career kind of situation. And besides, you don't necessarily want to be
a career assembly line worker.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, I really like this idea, and it's interesting. It would that we. You saw us work it out live, folks. We didn't talk about this ahead of time.
No, we didn't. It just totally happened right here with you people.
It did just totally happen with you people. So, where were we? iWatch. We're supposed to be talking about the iWatch. I do think it's coming this fall. And I do think it's going to be called an iWatch. And I do think it's going to be a wearable device on your wrist. So, we've all talked about this, and we've talked about how Apple seems poised to disrupt the med tech industry and possibly even medicine.
Well, bringing on a Food and Drug Administration expert, meaning someone that knows how to deal with the FDA for medical device approval processes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's really telling right there. You don't hire someone with that very specific skill set unless you really need it.
Right. And that's not to mention all the medical officers, the chief medical officers that we've talked about that Apple has hired away from some med tech companies.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to all the researchers that we've talked about that Apple has hired, all the, you know, sleep experts and the sensor experts and the fitness experts and the, you know, people This week, we've got two of Nike's disbanded Fuel Band team coming to Apple.
Yes.
Which is not surprising. I still think that Nike quit the Fuel Band because they knew that Apple was going to reshape this industry.
Yeah, they had insider information. Which would make sense because it's very like...
Tim's on Nike's board.
Right. And the Nike CEO said that the software that they're working on now, in lieu of creating the Fuel Band or future versions of the Fuel Band, is going to be used by Apple.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but one thing that we haven't explored much at all is Apple's potential impact on the mechanical luxury watch industry. And there's a reason for that. For one thing, of course, we tend to, you know, when we think of a wrist wearable, everybody in the world thinks what Samsung thought, which was, you know, poorly expressed in the gear.
So, oh my God, yeah.
It's a computer on your wrist that talks to your smartphone, and you know, and it's to a lesser extent, it's, you know, and what we said about Google Wear is Samsung's take on a wrist wearable device, but done correctly. But it's still thinking inside the box, right?
Very much inside the box.
Very much inside the box thinking. So, you know, when we think of the iWatch, we think of the computer industry, we think of the electronics industry, but the watch industry is a multi-billion dollar a year industry, and the luxury watch industry is its own little thing, its own little, you know, the. You know, we're talking, you know, the vast majority of devices that are sold in the luxury watch market, you know, probably start in that $800 to $2,000 price range. That's where, you know, people think of a Tag as a high-end watch.
They do.
And it's not. It's an entry-level watch. It's like a Movado. Movado is an entry-level high-end watch. I said entry-level watch. I meant an entry-level high-end watch.
I knew what you meant. Yeah.
Omega. Or Omega, depending on how you want to pronounce it. To a certain extent, they're kind of an entry-level watch, although I still enjoy their product placement in the first Daniel Craig
James Bond movie,
where the woman sitting across from him asks Rolex, and he goes, "No, Amiga." It's brilliant product placement. Brilliant, absolutely product. Just fantastic product placement, where Omega was trying to establish the idea that they're just as good as a Rolex. That, to me, a Rolex is kind of an entry-level watchmaker, too. Anyway, snobbery aside.
Yeah, holy crap, snobbery.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry about that. We've got this watch market, this luxury watch market. And I've been thinking now for a couple of months, I've been thinking about whether or not Apple could end up accidentally disrupting, although you and I just came up with that term earlier today, mm-hmm. but if Apple might end up accidentally disrupting that market.
Which is possible, because if they're making something that doesn't look like a Galaxy Gear or the whatever the new Moto watch is that's coming out, or the thing that LG just released, or a Pebble, then you might have more people interested in buying this thing. And if they're looking at it as something for people that want to have luxury watch wear, then they may unintentionally disrupt part of that market.
Well, part of the issue here is that you only have one wrist.
That's not true.
Well, that's
most people have two.
But you generally speaking only wear anything other than a bracelet tends to be worn on only one watch. There are very few people that wear two watches. Some people do, certainly.
Yeah, well, and the 80s came and went, so the whole Swatch thing is over.
Swatch is still a thing,
but wearing like six Swatch watches,
yeah,
not so much anymore.
Correct. That's absolutely.
You know, true. Whoever at Swatch got that to be a thing, I hope they got lots of really big bonuses.
No joke. But if and also many people in the high end watch market, the luxury watch market, we have to understand the we need to dive into the high end watch market just a little bit. The high end watch market makes a device that the vast majority are, like I said, in the $8,000 to $2,000 range, which is a lot of money to spend on a watch.
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of the profits coming from the $2,000 to $10,000 range. And then there are a smaller number of watches that are sold from, say, $10,000 to $100,000. And then after that, you've got really, really small numbers of devices that might actually cost, $250,000, that sort of thing.
Now, I'm assuming for watches like that, it's not like someone decides, hey, I'm going to go buy $250,000 watch. It's one of those things where you contact the company and say, I want a timepiece designed.
Yeah, or you there's actually some watch dealers that can get no. It's not that I want a timepiece design. No, absolutely not. There are devices that are made in small numbers that are prestige models, and sometimes it's merely the materials that are being used to make them. Sometimes it's actually more of the extreme number of complications. What really sets off mechanical watches is the number of complications, and there are particular complications that are very, very difficult to make, and those are the ones that tend to fetch a pretty price. But those are made in fairly small numbers.
Now, when you say complications, I think of awkward scenarios with lovers walking in on soap operas, but that's not what you mean.
It is not what I mean. We're talking about. I'm actually going to pull up some examples of this. It's been a while since I've done my research. We're talking about perpetual. Perpetual watches where perpetual complication where you don't, where like moon phases and dates and whatnot are, don't have to be reset for up to, you know, several hundred years.
Okay. That's actually, yeah, I think, that's really cool.
It is extraordinarily cool. And then you've got a tourbillon, which is designed to counterbalance the motion, the gravity, and it's designed to counteract gravity to keep the watch accurate. Gravity is actually one of the things that makes a watch inaccurate.
A mechanical watch.
Yes, a mechanical watch. And keep in mind that your most expensive, most ultra complicated watch, mechanical watch, is much less accurate than a 995 quartz watch. Quartz watches are other than an atomic clock, they're the most accurate watches that you can make.
And atomic clocks do cost a lot more.
Atomic clocks. Yes. Atomic clocks tend to be owned by large corporations and government entities.
Yes.
So it's these complications which end up costing a lot of money. But in the watch enthusiast market, many people have multiple watches, both from a collecting standpoint and from a, which watch shall I wear today kind of standpoint.
I picture you doing that in the morning.
Well, I only have the one watch.
I know, but you can still do it. Oh, which watch will I wear today?
Oh, I guess I'll wear the same one that I wore yesterday. James, please bring me my watch. And it turns out I don't have anybody named James working for me, and then I have to figure that out and put on my one watch. So, yes, people have more than one watch. Now, enter Apple with a device that, if it is doing medical monitoring, if it is doing health and fitness monitoring, it could become a device that people want to wear all the time, even people who might normally be attracted to
their fancy schmancy watch,
to their fancy schmancy mechanical watch,
which means that the fancy watch would end up getting left behind,
or that fewer fancy watches may be purchased by people who own more than one. I have thought about this from the standpoint of what the heck am I going to do? My guess is I'm going to be very attracted to Apple's device. My guess, I am mentally attracted already to the idea of having a device that is going to make me think differently about the way I live my life from a physical activity standpoint. I know that there are other products on the market, but I don't own any of them currently. And I will probably own an iWatch because it's part of my job. And I'm hoping that it makes me think differently about the way I live my life. And I've got this watch that I love. You know that I love my watch.
You do love that watch.
It's a Zenith Chronomaster XXL. And it is, I love this watch. I love this watch. What am I, could I be tempted to wear Apple's watch and put this into a watch winder that hardly, you know, that hardly ever comes out, possibly even never comes out? And if that could happen to me, it could happen to other people. And that could be Apple's accidental disruption of the watch market, because I don't think that Apple is going after the watch market. I think that Apple is going after a completely different market. And there you have it.
I think you're right that they're not going after the high-end luxury watch market. I just thought of something, though. What if they found a way to not accidentally disrupt that market by making the iWatch something that that can be easily removed from the band and worn discreetly in other ways?
Oh, that's possible. I kind of doubt that from the standpoint of measuring activity. Seems like there's going to be an optimal way to wear it for that. By definition.
You know, there are some very sophisticated things that are being done with the software in the various devices right now, so that certain devices can be worn, say, on your belt, or for a woman, clipped into their bra, or worn like a pendant. And so the device can figure out if it's on your wrist, if it's clipped to your belt, or if it's around your neck. And
Apple could probably do that at least as well as anybody else, if not better.
And that's my assumption. So so something like the Shine from Misfit, you can wear it on your wrist, you can clip it to your belt, or you can wear it as a pendant. And it looks like jewelry when you're
at
that
way. We know that Apple hired a sleep expert, one of the world's top sleep experts, if not the world's top sleep expert.
Right.
That we know of. Just that we know of.
And that has me very intrigued because it's no secret it that does I don't sleep.
Right, exactly. And it's to me, that implies that Apple is interested in making a device that's comfortable to wear when you sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's a thing. I don't want to... I mean, can you imagine wearing Galaxy Gear while you sleep?
No, you'd put an eye out with that thing.
You put an eye out. You know, people would wake up with bruises and, you know, cuts.
Oh, my God. I lost a tooth again.
Exactly. So, you know, and talking, you know, we've seen Tim Cook on with a Fuel Band on, which is this, you know, really slim profile device. You know, and I don't know. I would be interested to see if Apple can make it so that we can wear it in any number of ways and have it do what it's supposed to do. I don't know. We'll see. I think that there's a chance for Apple to do some accidental disruption of the luxury watch market, and really that would have the biggest effect, I think, on some of the niche designers you know, there's a lot of watchmakers out there who've gone on to launch their own brands, and they make only a few hundred or maybe a couple of thousand or a few thousand watches a year, and they make them all themselves or maybe with a really tiny team, that sort of thing. I think that those kinds of brands might get the most hurt put on them, whereas, you know, your brands like Tag and Rolex and Omega and on the higher end Paget, the really high end brands will probably continue to do just fine. Thank you. I don't know.
But I think it's pretty clear that there's a lot of people in the watch industry that are paying very close attention to what Apple's doing, because whatever it is will very likely have a real impact on them.
Yes, it probably will. Now, we had a reader, I always get your name wrong when I read it because of the W's, so I'm going to read it instead of remembering it. Either that, or maybe I'll just cut this out so that no one knows what a jerk I am.
You're not a jerk.
MRM Webmax. I always want to make it WRW. I don't know why I do that, sir. I do not know why I do that. You've been a loyal reader to us for a long time, and I always appreciate your input. Anyway, he linked to an article that TechHive did, where several executives from the luxury market poo-pooed the idea of
just the whole smartwatch thing.
Smartwatch market, and like here is this is the Stefan Linder, who is the TagHorse CEO. He said, and I'm quoting, "None impress me in terms of design. They look like..." He was referring to existing devices from Samsung, Sony, Qualcomm, and Pebble. "They look," quoting again, "they look like cheap plastic design watches in the luxury category where we work on every detail for crafted value. When I see the smartwatch, it's interesting, but in terms of design, it looks like a cheap wrist computer. There's not one that makes a great connection," which is such a great observation. And he's right. Everything he's saying, that's right. It's no surprise that the watch industry would poo-poo smartwatches. It's no surprise, right? It's a very conservative industry by definition. They're, mm-hmm. you know, they're doing things the way things were done 100 years ago. And that's part of their perceived value. Right? So it's no surprise to me that they would dismiss smartwatches. But his observations are entirely correct. And what's really interesting to me is that part of his observations actually speak directly to the way Apple does stuff. We work on every detail for crafted value. Well, Apple does that. Right? There's not one that makes a great connection. That's exactly what Apple focuses on. It focuses on is making their devices have a connection with you.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, Apple doesn't look at what features can we throw in for the sake of putting features on. They're looking at creating an experience for their users.
Yes.
And yeah, and I guess that's exactly what the high-end watchmakers are doing. They're making an experience for their customers.
Yes. It is right. It's precise. But yeah, and there's definitely, don't get me wrong, a big part of the watch industry is conspicuous consumption.
Sure.
You know, it's, you get, especially you get people with, you know, these giant, massive watches on their wrist that are absolute. I mean, that's about conspicuous consumption. And that's part of what fueled the resurgence of mechanical watches starting roughly in the year 2000, maybe the late 90s. But they do make a connection with people. The successful watches, the successful brands that have you know, resurged in the last couple of decades are the ones that have made these connections with customers, exactly like Apple has done.
And exactly what so many other watchmakers so far haven't done.
Correct.
Smart watchmakers.
People aren't smart. The smart watchmakers, yes. Right. And that's why smartwatches remain a laughed about niche.
Yeah. But that might be changing this fall.
I think it will change this fall. It's going to be interesting to see. And it's going to be interesting to see what kind of fallout this has in the luxury market. Now, we know that Apple hired the, was it the vice president? You did that story. The vice president of marketing?
Vice president of sales.
Vice president of sales from Tag. Mm-hmm. To,
they're not saying what he's doing.
We're not saying, yeah. The assumption, of course, is that he's going to be helping to market or sell the iWatch.
Right. And I think that's very likely. My guess is that if he's not doing that, he's going to be working directly with Angela Ahrendts in the retail side. But
could be.
But yeah. If that's the case, why not just say that's what he's doing?
Yeah, you would think that they would have announced that. And I did a story this week on Apple opening an Apple store in Basel, in Switzerland. It's the fourth Swiss Apple store. And this is a city with a massive population of 195,000, which is not massive at all, but is one of the largest cities in Switzerland. And what is interesting about Basel is that it is the site of the world's largest watch and jewelry, to be fair, trade show, but it's a watch trade show. And this is where all the brands come, all the luxury watch brands come to introduce the latest and greatest, especially the prestige devices that will sell in very limited numbers. And it's possible that it was just simply time for Basel to get an Apple store, but I can't help but feel that Apple wanted an Apple store in the city that hosts Baselworld for when the iWatch comes out. I can't help but feel there's a connection there.
You know, wouldn't that be kind of interesting?
Because Apple doesn't participate in trade shows. They're not going to be participating in Baselworld, and there's nothing for them in Baselworld, I might add. Baselworld is essentially the CES of the watch industry. So, you know, the retailers and watchmakers come. I think it's open to industry people only. I could be wrong about that. It's been a long time since I did any research on Baselworld. So press, you know, the same thing like CES, press, retailers, distributors, and vendors. And a lot of deals happen. A lot of these are the watches we're going to carry for the next year kind of deals happen.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a very big deal.
It's a very big deal for the watch industry. And, you know, I think that Apple is quite, wants to have a place where all these people that are coming can come and check out the iWatch while they're there. I may be making mountains out of molehills in this, but this is a strong gut feeling that I have.
That would be a pretty ballsy move on Apple's part.
Yeah. So that store opens in July. All right. We have actually, this is the longest we've talked about a single subject.
You know, I turned away from the counter for this one because I just didn't want to see exactly how long we were talking. But now that I look back, yes, it is. Yeah.
The longest. So let's move on to something else.
Geez, what else do we have?
Pick.
Hold on. I'm scrolling through the list to see something other than the iWatch. How about the whole thing that's happening with Amazon and writers and their fight with Hash 8?
All right. Well, let's see if we can make this one
less than 40 minutes.
Yeah, relatively short. So we've talked about the battle between Amazon and Hachette. Hachette is a publisher. It's a French-owned company. It's the Hachette Book Group is part of the broader Hachette conglomerate. So I think it's a $10 billion conglomeration. The book part of that is a lot smaller. In the U.S., they're the fourth largest of the big four publishers. Right, Simon and Schuster, HarperCollins, Penguin Random House, or is that right? I think it's Penguin Random House, and then we've got Hachette number four. And Hachette is the first of the publishers to have their distribution agreement with Amazon expire since they settled with the DOJ in the same case that Apple took to trial.
And how's that working out for them now?
For whom?
For Hache.
Well, it's what has happened is Hachette wants to take. They want to go back to the agency model. And on the flip side of that, Amazon actually wants to pay less for books than it was from its previous contracts. So we have a fight between the two companies that has resulted in Amazon pulling off, pulling buy buttons from Hachette titles, pulling pre-order options for Hachette titles, for telling customers that it would take weeks and weeks and weeks to deliver Hachette titles, and why don't you buy one of these other books by another author instead? And even and those like books that it did carry, discounting them less than they were discounting other people's books. And remember that they're, Amazon's claim to fame are two things: logistics and price.
Right.
Right. So it's been kind of a big deal. And what's happened is we've got the book industry largely uniting behind Hachette. Lots of published authors, including the big-time authors who absolutely have their bread buttered by the publishing industry, have come out in support of Hachette and against Amazon. And we've had some self-publishing people, including Hugh Howey, a very notable success story in the self-publishing world. He has a series that started with Wool. Was the first book that he had that... Wool.
And yeah. He's moved up to like... Cashmere?
No, I forget. It was actually a very clever title for that first book. He has come out in support of Amazon. So have a bunch of other self-published authors. And there are certainly authors who hate the publishing industry and think that Amazon is the bee's knees because Amazon has enabled people to self-publish. Amazon absolutely cracked the publishing industry's, let's be honest, stranglehold on publishing by allowing publishers to go direct through Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
We've had this bifurcation of the author world. Some people are heavily critical of Hachette, and some people are heavily critical of Amazon. But from everything that I've been able to ascertain, more authors have come out in favor of supporting Hachette in these negotiations. In part, including, by the way, I might add, authors published by other publishers because they see the writing on the wall. They know that
they're next.
Amazon is that they're next. Their publisher is next. And they know that if Amazon is paying less for books, because Amazon has 62% of the book market. I think they've got a higher percentage of the ebook market. But as a whole, they've got 62% of the book market here in the United States. And they know that whatever deal Amazon hammers out with Hachette is likely to be the same deal that's hammered out with their publisher. So they see the writing on the wall, and they understand that Amazon's race to the bottom means less money for them. And I will tell you that as a reader, I know that it means less good books for me to read. I'm also a wannabe author. I'm in the process of trying to sell my first novel. So I've got a horse in this race too. Or at least I've got a wannabe horse in this race.
Now it's a real horse.
Fair enough, but not as much as, say, James Patterson, who releases 17 books a year somehow. 15 books a year.
He has to buy crazy, lots of keyboards.
Crazy, crazy number of books that Mr. Patterson releases. And anyway, what happened this week is that Amazon wrote a letter to, quote-unquote, some authors and to the Authors Guild, the president of the Authors Guild, saying, what would you think if we proposed to Hachette that authors get to keep 100% of the purchase price of ebooks? Now, what that, of course, means is 100% of the purchase price of Kindle ebooks.
Right, which also means that Amazon isn't really out anything, but the publishers would be getting less money.
Well, Amazon, of course, would be getting less money. Of course, they're getting even less money right now. They're getting no money right now because they're not selling these books. But there are definitely some interesting aspects of this proposal. First of all, it wasn't a direct proposal. It was something they floated through authors, and, you know, surprise, surprise, the letter leaked to the press, which is, I think, what it was designed to do.
Of course.
I don't think that Amazon knew that Hachette could never accept this. But here's the deal. So Amazon's take from an ebook is roughly 30%. It's not agency model currently, and it may even be less than 30% because Amazon discounts. But for the sake of argument, let's call it roughly 30%. So Amazon is willing to give up 30% of its sales to give to the authors. This is the idea here is that authors are getting hurt by these negotiations. And they are. Some authors are getting hurt by these negotiations. Right, you know, if any author who's releasing a new book, especially the established authors, they're releasing a new book and it's not available on Amazon, well, there's a lot of sales that they aren't going to get.
Sure.
So Amazon's like, well, let's make this easy for the author. So, you know, we'll just give them all the money. But what that really means is that Hachette gives 70% of the money and Amazon gives 30% of the money. And of course, what this actually means is that Hachette is giving up 70% of the money that represents 40% of their income, and Amazon is giving up, I think, something like 30% of the money that represents 7% of their sales. So 30% of 7%.
So really, this isn't that big of a deal for Amazon.
Yes, yeah, it's not only not that big of a deal for Amazon. The financially, it puts all of the burden on Hachette. But it does so in a way that extends the Kindle monopoly.
Huh, how about that?
Yeah, how about that? Because all these people, this wasn't 100% of all the physical books that are being sold. This was ebook specifically. And they said ebooks, but that means Kindle.
Yes, that means Kindle.
And so this entire process would only serve to steer more people to Kindle, giving Amazon more share, which is all they want. They want all the share. And it does so in a way that then means that Amazon could wait forever until Hachette takes exactly the terms that it wants.
So that sounds like a pretty sweet deal for Amazon.
Yeah. Hachette could never accept it. It was never intended to be accepted. What it was intended to do is to reduce the number of negative comments coming from the author side of the industry aimed at Amazon. This was designed to turn attention and aim it back at Hachette when Hachette refused to take this deal. And it turns out that most writers are not stupid. And so far they've actually seen right through this. It's an interesting it's been interesting to watch. You know, I hang out in a writer's forum, and the conversation on this topic has been quite interesting. But the vast majority of it there has been in favor of Amazon, and I'm sorry, of Hachette. And here's the deal: these are two large corporations. They don't really care about the authors. Yes, I'm sure that some of the editors care about their authors.
Sure,
I'm sure they do, because they're human beings. Most of them are good people. But we're talking about multi-billion-dollar companies. They don't really care about the authors. Neither side does. But if Amazon gets what it wants, which is to pay less for books, it means fewer resources that will go towards developing new authors, to editing even current authors, you know, even big-time authors. It'll mean less marketing money. It'll mean lower advances, which, you know, and it's very hard to write for a living. And this will result in books that are less good, right? So it's not that I personally support Hachette, and I think that Hachette is the good guy here. It's just I think that Hachette's goals are more closely aligned to my goals, not only as a wannabe author, but as a reader, and more importantly, as a reader. I want good books to read. I want great books to
read. Now, I wonder how many people, book readers, are not realizing that that what Amazon's proposing ultimately has a negative impact on the quality and quantity of books that will be available on shelves.
Well, there are certainly some people. If you read through the comments of anybody who talks about any, especially the main, any kind of, like if it's an author blog, or when it's the New York Times that's covering this, the New York Times has covered this extensively. You know, the publishing industry is largely based in New York City. But if you read through the reader comments, you'll find lots of people who go that, you know, books cost too much money. You know, Amazon is fantastic because they've lowered prices and all this business, which is very true for short term. It's the long term that I look at. I look at the fact that I already see more typos in books today than I did 20 years ago.
And that's really frustrating, reading a book with typos.
It is frustrating. And a lot of this is because the margins have been crushed in the book industry, thanks to Amazon, because Amazon has two cudgels with which to bludgeon the competition. One is logistics, and they're fantastic at logistics, and amazing at logistics. And the other is price. Amazon is willing to lose money. Amazon has dumped bestsellers in order to gain share. They sell them for less than they pay for them so that they can have more share and put other retailers out of business, right? That's what Amazon has done, and that's why Amazon had 90% of the ebook market when Apple went to publishers in advance of the release of the iPad. 90% of the ebook market. They had monopoly power in the book market here in the United States. And
That's really hard to compete against.
And there was no competition. There was no competition in ebooks. Because why compete when you can't make any money? Why make an investment in an ebook platform when you can't make any money from that investment? Because Amazon is just going to dump everything below cost. Mm-hmm. And that's why Apple armed the publishers with the most favored nation clause that allowed the publishing industry to switch to agency pricing. And the reason why that was important is not only did Apple not want to compete on price, Steve Jobs actually made a comment about saving the publishing industry. You know, he saw the race to the bottom. We saw the race to the bottom in the 90s with the PC industry.
Yeah, we know how that works out.
Yeah. Dell led the race to the bottom. And everybody's competing on price. And so what do we get? We get cheap computers that are poorly made, that are cheaply made, and no one's investing in any kind of new technology except for Microsoft and Intel and then Apple. Right? None of the PC manufacturers are doing any R&D unless it's possibly into manufacturing techniques, which is what Dell did. Of course, Dell eventually got outdelled by China, where the cheapness of labor costs overwhelmed Dell's advancements in manufacturing here in the States. right? And so eventually Dell wasn't able to compete on price.
There's anymore. Some irony in that.
There's some tremendous irony, LOL, Dell. And Apple is the company that changed those rules. Apple stopped competing on price, started competing on experience and style, and was able to sell computers for enough money to do research into new products and technologies. And that's why Apple leads the computer industry, right? The race to the bottom, when you suck the profits out of an industry, quality goes out the window. It just goes out the window. I love quality. I love quality books. I want good books. I'm willing to pay for them.
Well, you're already seeing that quality go away.
We have already seen that quality, and I want to draw that line. I don't want quality to go away any further. I saw a tweet recently where someone said something to the effect of, you know, it's weird. I forget exactly how they worded it, but they said that, you know, we'll pay $4 for a greeting card and I don't know, $3 for something else that was like,
you know, cup of coffee.
Something like that. And yet people complain about paying $2.99 for a book. Well, there's a problem with that.
There's a big problem with that, yeah.
There's a huge problem with that.
Well, unfortunately, we're seeing this race to the bottom, and have seen it for a long time. You talked about it for Dell. We've seen this in the app market. Like, go to buy an app for your iPhone. If it's more than 99 cents, people are just balking. And I've paid, I think $70 for an iPad app.
Would that be from the Omni Group?
That would be from the Omni Group, yes.
Because they're proud enough of their software to charge real money for it.
And it's really good software.
And they make great software.
Yeah, they do.
And they support it.
They support it wonderfully. Yeah, it's just amazing. Yeah.
You get what you pay for.
And granted, when I'm paying $70 for an app, it's not a game. It's a business tool.
Yeah, absolutely. But I look at Zynga. You know, Zynga, Scramble Friends. I love this game. This is a Boggle ripoff. I don't like the fact that Zynga rips off everybody, but despite that, I still play Scramble with Friends. And the way they have wanted to monetize Scramble with Friends is to make each game cost a number of coins, and coins generate at the rate of one every 10 minutes. And there are like power-ups that you can do to give you either more time or some other advantage in your game. I personally, for what it's worth, I use 2 15-second time extensions, and then I use a third one that if you find three words that it also gives you 15 seconds.
Okay, so if you don't get these extensions, then the game becomes unplayable for a certain amount of time?
Well, you're going to be a lot less competitive. Yeah. So each game costs one coin. It's one coin to play. You get one extension for free. You get one bonus for free. You get a second bonus for one coin, and then you get a third bonus for three coins. So if you're going to play on even footing with everybody else, that's five coins per
round,
you know, per game. Yeah. And it takes, you know, and it takes us 50 minutes worth of time of not playing to be able to play one game. And then there's, of course, extensions that you can actually pay US dollars for, or you can buy additional coins if you want to play more games. I'm not going to do that. I'll pay you $10 for this game. I will not spend a dime on a coin. I will not spend a dime on a coin. I will not spend a dime on any of the US dollar only bonuses.
I don't think I'm playing any Zynga games anymore.
Zynga is, yeah, well, and don't get me wrong, this is apparently working for them. They have.
Well, if it didn't work, they wouldn't be doing it.
They wouldn't be doing it. I realize that. I personally am not going to buy into it. I'm not going to pay for a coin. I won't pay for in-game currency for any game unless I think the game is tremendous and it's the only way I can support the company. Like I did that with Space Cadet.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
Which is a modern take on Space Invaders, and they give away that game for free. It's a fantastic game. I bought in-game currency solely for the standpoint of supporting the company. But I wish they'd actually just let me pay for the game.
Well, they're probably making more money this way than if they sold the game outright.
Probably, yeah, because there's a race to the bottom, because everybody gives away their game for free, and they look for in-app purchases to actually monetize everything.
Sure.
And this to kind of bring it back to what we're talking about. The race to the bottom is a bad thing.
It is. And it doesn't matter if it's in the book industry, the game industry, or the computer industry.
I totally agree. Totally agree. All right. We have run out of time. We had a third topic.
No, we didn't.
That we shall not get into.
There you go. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. Thanks for listening. Feel free to follow me on Twitter or app.net. I'm Jay Gamm at both places.
You can follow me on Twitter at TM O'Brien. It's Brian with a Y. Our content is written by the good people at the Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for us. And that's all for
this. And as always, stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer.